Welcome to episode 97 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes, and I'm continuing on my quest to catch up on all those episodes of the podcast that I recorded in the second half of 2025, but didn't actually get round to publishing. Two podcasts ago, episode 95, we travelled the length of the UK along Le Jog, Land's End to John O'Groats. In the last episode, we travelled all the way to Iran. And in this episode, we're off to an island. It's not the first time the Cycling Europe podcast has visited an island. On the contrary, we've been to the Outer Hebrides. We've been to the Isle of Wight. We've been to Tenerife. We've been to Shetland. We've been to the Orkney Isles. But in this episode, we're heading into the middle of the North Atlantic, and we're going to the Faroe Islands with Tristram Nui. All about that in a few minutes. But before we head to the Faroe Islands, I received an email this week, and it was from somebody in a marketing company somewhere, and they said, would I accept an advert for the Cycling Europe podcast? And I thought, okay, an advert. I've never gone down the route of adverts. I've never been asked to by anybody to put an advert on the podcast before. And don't worry, there is no advert in this episode of the podcast. But it did get me thinking. I thought, well, how much do people pay for adverts? So I did a bit of Googling, and I went on to Spotify, and I went on to Apple Podcasts, just to look at the statistics. One of the problems that, well, I say problems, it's not really a problem because I'm not really that bothered, but I have no idea how many people listen to this. It could be five people. It could be a million people. I don't think it's a million people because I think I would probably receive more emails asking for adverts to be placed on the podcast, but it's probably somewhere in between, and it's probably a lot closer to five than it is a million. But I really have no ideas. I do know that there are subscribers via Spotify and Amazon and Apple, and I think Spotify about 1,500 people, something like that. Similar number on Apple Podcasts. But I would love to know how many people do listen. The problem is it's impossible to know. But anyway, when I was looking on Apple Podcasts, I did look at the reviews. I don't see the reviews very often because I don't go looking for them. But there have been 66 ratings on Apple Podcasts. And so far, there's an average of 4.8 out of 5. And as it happened, somebody had just written a review. It's from somebody called JLG Aka Greeky. And it was posted 2 weeks ago. Unique and calming, 5 stars. There's a lovely slow pace to these podcasts, a bit different to all the other cycling podcasts. I look forward to and enjoy every minute. I don't actually listen to cycling podcasts myself. That's a bit of an admission to make, isn't it? But there aren't that many cycle touring podcasts out there. And I don't tend to listen to podcasts which are about cycle racing. I do listen to increasingly running podcasts because I've been running for the last 18 months. And I do listen to the Archers podcast on Radio 4, plus one or two others. But I don't really listen to cycling podcasts. So it would be interesting to, I did wonder whether I should have a podcast all about cycling podcasts because clearly they're very, very different to this one, but I'm intrigued to know as to what they are actually like. So if you are an expert on cycling podcasts and fancy coming on this podcast to talk about them, then feel free, especially if they're all about cycle touring and travel and that kind of thing. I did also receive this week a donation from somebody called Cormac, and he put a very nice message on Ko-fi, which is where people donate, and he said, thank you for such a wonderful podcast, Andrew. I really enjoy each episode. It's nice to get some inspiration for some new destinations and be reminded of how nice people are across the world. If you'd like to donate to the podcast and help support the podcast, there are costs involved, then you can do so like Cormac did by visiting cyclingeurope.org/support. And if you'd like to get in contact with the podcast, perhaps you're that podcast expert who can come and tell us all about all the other cycling podcasts that I don't listen to, then the contact details are at cyclingeurope.org/contact. So without further ado, we better get back to why we're here, which is to listen to Tristram Nwy. Tristram Nwy, who earlier in 2025 visited the Faroe Islands with his bike. And I asked him to start by introducing himself.
My name's Tris Nwy. I'm a civil servant, lives down in the south of England in Hampshire, on the edge of the New Forest.
And it's not the first time you've appeared on the podcast. Can you tell us about the previous time?
Yeah, the previous time, I think we met at the 2022 Cycle Touring Festival, where I was giving a talk about a ride I did following the route of a H.G. Wells story. And I was just describing the fact that you could reproduce that route today and still have a good cycle tour.
Yeah, and I've just Googled it, and this is a sign of the times. There's an AI overview of what we did. It says, Tristram Nwy was a guest on the Cycling Europe podcast, episode 60, where he discussed his experience of cycling the route from H.G. Wells' 1896 novel, The Wheels of Chance.
Yeah, that's the one.
The episode was released on the 16th of October 2022 and featured Nwy, a science... Ah, hang on, this is AI going wrong here. It describes you as a science fiction writer from Southampton.
I do a bit of writing, and so that's not totally inaccurate, but it's a more of a hobby. It's not something I've ever done and have published, but I have written some science fiction works. So.
Would you prefer AI to describe you as a science fiction writer or a civil servant?
I like it that it's describing me as a science fiction writer. That sounds much cooler.
Yeah, well, there you go. You've just reinvented yourself, courtesy of AI.
Perfect. Happy with that.
But sticking to the non-science fiction writer stuff, your role as a civil servant requires you to travel a bit. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I work for the Coast Guard within the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. So I basically work in emergency planning. So I work with colleagues across different countries who prepare plans for responding to emergencies at sea. And it does take me around to various parts of Europe and internationally from time to time. And the reason I was in the Faroes was because I was meeting with colleagues as part of a project there, which... I've been to previously in December last year, but being December, it's very, very dark up there. You don't see very much. But I did have the opportunity to go back in June and combine both the meeting and some leave, which seemed to be a very sensible thing to do.
So we're going to be talking about the Faroe Islands and your experiences of cycling on the Faroe Islands. Now, most people will have heard of the Faroe Islands, but it's arguably one of those places that people potentially get mixed up with Iceland or even perhaps Greenland or perhaps even Shetland and Orkney. Could you tell us where the Faroe Islands are and how you get there?
Yeah, so you're right. The Faroe Islands, if I ask people I know anything about them, they do have that whole query of, well, I've heard of them, but I don't know where they are. They're kind of a bit of a mystical place that exists vaguely in people's awareness, but not with any certainty. They're a fairly small group of islands that are located roughly midway between Scotland and Iceland. If you drew a line between the two, you'd find the Faroe Islands along that line.
How do you get there?
In terms of getting there, you've got a couple of options. One is to take a ferry, which goes from the north of Denmark. And that ferry takes, I think, about 36 hours to get to, or maybe 48 hours to get to Faroes, and whence it then carries on to Iceland and does a return trip. And I think they run once a week or twice a week. Or you can fly. Now, for 6 months of the year, that means going to Copenhagen and getting connected flight. But during the summer months, roughly from May through to September, October, you can fly direct flights from Edinburgh and from Gatwick as well. So that's the quickest and most convenient way of getting there. But that's really your only choices. fly or ferry from Denmark.
So how did you get there?
I flew. So being relatively close to Gatwick, getting to Gatwick Airport is a fairly easy thing to do. What I did for this trip to make it easier for the travel and logistics was to use my Brompton, which I'd never taken abroad on a flight before. So I thought it was a good opportunity for me to do that as well. So a fair bit of learning was had from that. So yeah, just took the train over to Gatwick, packed the bike up at the airport, loaded it onto the plane with fingers crossed that it will get to the other side undamaged and get it out of the airport the other side. It was very easy.
And in terms of its size, looking at the map here, it looks about roughly the same size as the Shetland Isles. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's pretty comparable, I think, in terms of total area. The way that the islands in the Faroes are geographically dispersed, they may have a little bit more land area because there's a lot of inlets and a lot of wriggly bits, if you like, on the coastline. I think overall there's probably a little bit more area than there is in the Shetland, but in terms of its footprint, it's quite similar.
And having been to Shetland last year, and having never been to the Faroe Islands, but looking at the pictures on the Tourist Office website, and there's an article which appeared in Cyclist magazine, which I've got in front of me. Looking at those pictures, it looks more like the Lofoten Islands, which I have visited, than perhaps Shetland, which is relatively flat and undulating. It's a bit more dramatic, so it reminds me of the Lofoten Islands.
Yeah, that's the thing that attracted me to spending some time to explore them. And you're right, whereas the Shetlands are fairly low-lying by comparison, the Faroes, the land emerges pretty steeply out of the sea, pretty much anywhere you are, in with a few exceptions in the Faroe Islands. And it generally goes up to about 250, 300 metres elevation. And that's true of the whole island group. Whichever island you're on, and some parts of it have extremely steep-sided seaward-facing cliffs. Others have a fairly sort of a steep slope into fjords and inlets and so on. And it's quite dramatic in that regard, because pretty much everywhere you look, that's what you can see. I think in terms of their geology, the Faroes themselves were constructed through a series of volcanic eruptions. I think they were kind of a genesis with near Iceland and then moved out into the Atlantic over time. And you can see that in the geology, because all of the steep-sided valleys are all characterized by horizontal layers, three or four layers of clear strata all the way through it. So you can tell it's had a genesis through volcanism, volcanic eruption and so on. And I think it was 60,000 years ago or more. So, very dramatic.
And like on the Lofoten Islands, you know, those mountains, those hills might only be, in inverted commas, be only 200-300 metres high. But the fact is that they are starting at sea level. You know, I live at 300 metres, but obviously where I live, I'm nowhere near the sea. You get the full, or you can appreciate the full height of the 300 metres when they are right next to the sea. They do look very spectacular in that setting. Politically, are the Faroe Islands an independent country, or are they similar to Shetland and Orkney, whereas they're just part of Denmark?
Yeah, so Faroes is a protectorate of Denmark, but it's pretty much its own country in many ways, has its own language, has its own currency. It's effectively aligned with the Danish krona. You can use either the local currency or the Danish currency equally in all the shops there. So, and I'm sure there's some ties to Denmark in regards of its sort of fiscal management and support from the Danish government and so on. But it has its own government, its own head of state and so on as well. So it's probably a bit more like I think maybe a bit more like the Isle of Man or the Channel Islands in that regard, in its relationship with Denmark, but fairly unique, I think, otherwise in that respect.
And interesting that they have their own language. Presumably the majority of people speak English.
They do. I mean, yes. I mean, I think the main language is Faroese, and Danish is the second language, but pretty much everybody can speak English and does speak English as well. I found that everybody I met happy to speak in English as well. So no problems with communication.
So you were there for 6 nights, 6 days, 6 nights. Is that right?
Yeah. Overall. Yeah. A week in total. Yes.
So your first 3 days are work-related stuff, and then the second bit is when you got on the bike. What was your plan in terms of where you went, and did you change where you were staying, or did you base yourself in one place?
I did do a fair bit of planning. I'm a bit of a planner. I like to know where I'm heading to and so on. And in the research that I'd done, because I was going to be camping, I wanted to make sure I had somewhere to camp when I got there. And I made the assumption, because it was June, that it was going to be starting to get busy at these campsites. So I'd pre-booked ahead just to make sure I'd got a slot. I'll come back to later on how that worked out. I mean, in the end, it looks like I didn't need to do that. So I did have destinations in mind, but I also had a route that would take me from Torshavn, the capital, where I was starting from, out to the east and ending at the a location sort of as far east as I was going to head to, and then get public transport back on the last day to head to the airport. But I hadn't counted for the fact that it was a bank holiday on the last day, which meant that the buses were not running as much as I had thought they would. So rather than risk getting stranded, I changed my plans and made it a circular route in order to make sure I got back to the airport in time. But I still managed to get to two of the destinations that I was going to camp at in total. And perhaps that's something worth reflecting on around that, the logistics of that, because the islands themselves, while they're pretty well connected in terms of roads and buses, you can actually get a long way off the beaten track as well at the same time, just by dint of your navigational choices. So you have to be mindful of whether you're going to be able to make your links or get yourself back to where you want to be without dedicating yourself to a very long ride.
Did you consider staying in a hotel? Because presumably you stayed in a hotel when you were doing your work bit. And was it an option, especially bearing in mind you were on a Brompton with limited ability to carry your stuff? Did you consider just staying in hotels instead?
I did look at Airbnbs. The thing is, there's only hotels in the main towns and cities, the main two cities, really. After that, you're down to guest houses and Airbnbs. They're quite expensive and few and far between. And actually, there were no hotels actually available on the days we were working out of Torshavn. We ended up renting an Airbnb for the purposes of basing ourselves there anyway. So, and that's one thing to bear in mind, that in the busy season, so pretty much from June through the summer season, everything is booked up. There's a quite active walking scene in the Faroes. A lot of people come across to do that. And it's becoming, I think, quite popular as a tourist destination, and certainly the Faroes are pushing that. So the hotels get booked up really, really quickly. I wanted to camp partly just to do that with the Brompton, and as an opportunity to really try some lightweight camping as well. And also the campsites themselves are in the more remoter, prettier places. So it just seemed sensible to me to plan it around doing that. But I did look into using some Airbnbs. I thought it would be useful if the weather was bad. But yeah, there's actually quite hard to find any.
Do they have a similar approach to wild camping that they have elsewhere in Scandinavia?
I was just about to say on that, actually, wild camping is not allowed.
Yeah.
It's a shame because there are so many places you could wild camp out there. But no, you're not actually allowed to do it. In some respects, I can understand why. I mean, there's a lot of grazing on just off the roadside. So in the hills, there's a lot of grazing. But I think actually one of the reasons is safety, because when the weather turns in the Faroes, the hillsides go from a fairly dry, inviting looking place to a waterfall. Basically, literally every few meters there, waterfalls erupt or start to come down the hillside. So I would think if you did try to wild camp, you'd want to be very careful about that anyway, if you didn't want to get caught out in a sudden downpour of water from the hillside.
So where were the three campsites that you used? I've got the map in front of me. There's Torshavn, and I've already spotted. Did you stop in the campsite in Torshavn?
I didn't. No, there is one there, but I was fortunate enough to be able to just use the Airbnb we've been using for work the night before I left. So there is a campsite there. I'm sure it's fine. I didn't actually see it, but no, I went from Torshavn up to Vest Manor, which is to the northwest of Torshavn. There's a good campsite at Vest Manor, and from there, the majority of campsites are actually then to the north. And I think that just reflects the northern parts of the islands are the more wilder parts of the islands. Everywhere's wild, but they're the more wilder. And the further northeast you go, the more picturesque it gets as well. So you're kind of limited in some respects if you're going to go camping by where the campsites are. So I basically followed that logic. What could I get to in the day? So yeah, Vest Manor was the first destination. I then went backtracked a little way and then up to the north to a place which I think is pronounced E-E-E-D. It's E-I-D-I, which is at the very northern end of the main island. And then I was going to go to a campsite that's free at a place called Eldervik, but in the end I didn't actually make it there for various reasons. Outside of that, there are more campsites further east and there are more campsites on the islands to the south, but they all require ferry connections or getting through undersea tunnels, which adds a lot of time. I didn't have the time to explore those and get to them, so I limited myself to what I could reach on the road connections.
So you were mainly, in fact, your 3 days were spent, it looks to me as though there are two main islands.
Yeah.
The one where you've got Torshavn,
yeah,
and then the one slightly to the northeast.
That's correct.
Right, and you stayed on those two islands, yeah?
I stayed on those two, and then on the last day, I went to a third island, which is the one furthest to the west, Vega, I think it's called. Vega, anyway, the one to the west, which is where the airport's located. So I did three of the islands, yeah.
And to access that third island, did you have to get a ferry?
No, that third island's connected by a tunnel. So the Faroes have got a lot of tunnels that have been constructed to connect the islands together. They all go under the sea or through mountains to negate the need to go over mountain roads. So, and that's something that if you're cycling there, you just have to be mindful of, that while you're allowed to cycle through the tunnels that go through the hillsides, for the most part, not all of them, but for the most part you can, you've got to be careful about the tunnels that go under the sea. Some of them you're allowed to cycle through, and others you're not, and you can get fined if you do cycle through them. But I did not fancy cycling through those tunnels because certainly the one that connects the main island to Vega, where the airport is, it's a 60-mile-an-hour road. It's quite dark. It's very long, and I didn't fancy that. So I took the bus through that tunnel just to prevent, just to get around the cycling issue. Other people have done it, but it wasn't something I fancied doing.
Yeah, again, thinking of Norway and thinking of cycling through Norway, which is what I did back in 2015, or 10 years ago, wow. The criteria really for cyclists being able to use the tunnels was whether there was a viable alternative. And if there was a ferry, you generally found that the tunnel was banned or cyclists were banned from the tunnels. If there wasn't, and this did happen on a few occasions, if there wasn't a viable alternative, for example, a couple of the undersea tunnels, then you were allowed to use them. But I did find that a really unnerving experience because of the, it felt like the proximity of the vehicles, but it was the noise rather than anything else. And when you had these vehicles approaching you from behind, which you couldn't see, the noise was extremely loud and you had no idea how close these vehicles were. But there's a picture, I'm just looking at a picture now, on the Cyclist magazine article, and there are two cyclists there cycling through a tunnel. Don't know whether it's an undersea tunnel or whether it's through one of the mountains, but that looks like a pretty wide tunnel and you've got space on one side should you need to move over if there's something coming behind you that you don't fancy sharing space with.
Yeah, I think it varies. And I think what you're saying about using a ferry rather than a tunnel, if that exists, is probably good advice, and actually probably more picturesque as well, certainly safer. I think so. The tunnels do vary quite a lot. There are some that go through the mountains. Some of them are only one car wide. You have to wait for the tunnel to be clear. in order to go through them. If I'd followed my original route, I would have cycled through one or two of those. But certainly from looking at Google Maps or Google Street View, you can see that they're quite small and narrow. The undersea ones are quite wide. And interestingly, the one that connects the island where the airport is to the mainland, there is no ferry alternative. So you have to use the tunnel. And that tunnel is doesn't have much of a side, you know, to the road. There's a small pavement, but it's really not even wide enough to ride on, and that is quite a busy tunnel. So I think, you know, I did see people cycling through it on the last day. They'd clearly cycled through the tunnel. I know other people have done it, but it would be, I think for me, I'd find that quite unnerving, really, to try and do that.
And the bus that you took, was it easy to get the bike on the bus?
Yeah, so the buses that serve the main routes are not really buses in the way that we think of the bus. They're more like coaches. So they've got the compartments underneath that you can put all the luggage and stuff on. And that's because they service the airport and the main towns quite a lot. So they're quite happy to take bicycles on them. But if the bus is very busy, they may ask you to wait for the next bus and they'll get you on that one. And the reason being that certainly from the airport, you can pre-book tickets. So if the bus is already pre-booked for people who have just got bags and suitcases, they can fit them all on. If there's space, they can still take a full-size bicycle just by putting it underneath. But when I was there, I did see that somebody said, yeah, you can get on the next bus, we'll get you on that, but we can't take you on this one. And the buses run every hour or every half hour or something like that. So it's not too bad. Of course, with the Brompton, I just folded it up and stuck it underneath and it was fine. And that was one of my thoughts with taking the Brompton, is that I could use the buses if I needed to shortcut some of the journeys and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, just one last thing on the tunnels. There was, people might have seen it, there was a report on the BBC News, and you can probably go back and re-find it on the BBC website. And it was all about the tunnels that have been built in recent years in the Faroe Islands. And the report was in the context of Shetland wanting, or a group of people in Shetland wanting to do a similar thing. And apparently all these tunnels in the Faroe Islands were privately financed, or they borrowed the money to build them, and then they're just paying the money back through tolls that people have got to pay. So whether or not that's a viable option for Shetland, well, certainly there are a group of people who think that it is.
Well, they've certainly done a lot of tunnelling. And yes, you're right. Some of that money has been recouped through tolls through the main tunnels. No, not all tolls. A lot of the tunnels are free, I believe. So how they've financed it and how they made the model work, I'm not sure. But it does seem to be something that's worked for them. And of course, it's opened up the Faroes more to tourism, because with more tunnels, you can drive around the islands a bit easier and get access. So I'm sure they've balanced the cost against the increased income from tourism. And certainly I get the impression, from what I can see, tourism is being pushed and has been taken up quite considerably in the last 10 years or so. And speaking to people at the airport when I was leaving, they were going on a walking tour, and others I met on the island as well who were there particularly for walking tours was seemed to be quite popular. And everywhere you go, you find hire cars at various destinations or passing you on the road. So there's a lot of people that are coming across hiring a car, and I think they've even now got hire car tour routes that take you to the key destination points. And I think added to that, the ferry in the summer months, it's a very popular destination for people from Denmark as well, bringing across their camper vans and so on. It's definitely something they've benefited from having done that.
So what was the cycling like? Was it more strenuous than you imagined? Was it easier? I suppose the weather must have played a massive factor, as it does on most islands.
It did. Overall, in terms of the actual cycling, the physicality of cycling, it kind of met my expectations that it was going to be somewhat challenging for me, because not being the most fittest in my that I've ever been at the moment, it was take a Brompton to somewhere that's very hilly and suffers from severe weather quite more often than not, you do have the chance of having some pretty difficult days. So my main concerns were how I was going to cope with the hills, a lot of the routes that I were taking to avoid the main roads and to avoid the tunnels was by necessity taking me over the mountains, which was great because I wanted to see the views. So that's where I wanted to go anyway. But it just meant there's going to be climbing involved, somewhere around 400, 600 meters minimum per day, and more with side excursions and so on. So that was a factor. And then the weather was my biggest concern. I went prepared for it to be very wet. In the end, I was really fortunate. Although it got rained on all but one day, it wasn't particularly heavy or long lasting. And what was really nice for me is I didn't have to contend with any winds. It was fairly benign the whole time I was cycling. The 3 days I was there beforehand with work, the weather was terrible. It was really windy, really wet. And I thought, oh goodness, if it's like this, you know, when I set off, I probably won't make my destinations without having to give up and get a bus or a taxi or hitchhike, which is an option there, apparently, if you can get in a car with a Brompton meant I could possibly do that. But yeah, I was fortunate. The weather eased off. So the biggest challenge was climbing the hills. But what I found, and it seems to be the case, is that the maximum gradient that they've built any of the roads on is sort of around 10-11%. Very few of the roads go above that unless you're using some of the really sort of smaller one-way access roads to mountaintops and so on. So it was just slow, steady climbing for the most part. And the Brompton handled it really well. I thought it did it really good. So you can go there with a Brompton, or you can hire a bike there, or if you want to go through taking your own bike there, that is possible too. And it's, yeah, really, really good riding.
I'm looking on the Visit Faroe Islands website here, and they've got a really good few pages dedicated to cycling, including 8 routes that they suggest. Did you follow the routes that they've got on their website, or did you make up your own route?
I made up my own routes, but I did look at those to get some inspiration and some ideas. But in the end, because of the limits of the time I had, it was kind of fairly straightforward to choose where I was going to go, because I wanted to have no more than 50 miles between my two destinations for each day. I think with more time, you can do a more bespoke route and use those as guides. Because what I would have liked to have done, if I had more time, I'd have liked to have got to the islands to the northeast, because those are the more spectacular, steep-sided, more remote islands, and perhaps to the ones furthest to the south, which require a ferry trip, because those islands are also having a fairly unique, according to the locals that I met anyway, in that they're a bit more like out of time, if you like. So it would have been nice to visit them. So yeah, I think those guides that are on the website are pretty good. I noticed as well, you sent me through some things you'd had, and one of them was for gravel riding. And one thing I did notice when I was riding up the higher parts of the hills, there was lots of gravel tracks that headed off out into the wilderness that looked pretty rideable. And I did think, well, if I had a different bike or if I had more time, that looks like it would be really interesting, because it's so wild and it feels so remote once you get off the beaten track. It would have been nice to have done some side adventures. So yeah, definitely something worth looking at.
Mm. In fact, there are, correct myself, there are 10 routes on their website, not 8. I missed the 2 at the bottom. Did you meet many other cyclists when you were there?
That was something that I was quite surprised about. And I did wonder what it would be like riding my bike in there. In the end, I met one other cyclist. That was it. And the whole 4 days, I did see. So when I arrived, there were some people getting a bike out and unboxing it at the airport. And I did think, well, how are they getting on? Because the 3 days of weather was terrible from that point onwards. And I saw one of them coming back into Torshavn off the mountain road, as it happens, on that third day that I was working in Torshavn, and they looked pretty wet. And that's one of the things that gave me pause. I thought, well, tomorrow I'm going up that road. If it's like that then, how will I look coming out the other end? But no, I didn't see any others until the night of the second day, when another cyclist arrived at the campsite. And that was a chap from Denmark who'd come over for a couple of days and hired the bike in Torshavn. He was just doing 2 days, went up to EE and back. And yeah, I met him there, and I bumped into him again on the fourth day as he was coming back to Torshavn. We just happened to meet again. And that was it. That was the only cyclist I saw, which is really surprising. I thought I was going to perhaps see some more. But rode the whole days without seeing another person on a bicycle.
Yeah, especially bearing in mind that you were there in June obviously the longest days are in June, and you would think if people had the choice of going in June, which, you know, lots of people do, lots of people are not necessarily stuck to school holidays, then that would be the time to go. You didn't happen to be there on the solstice, did you?
No, I was earlier than that. It was the beginning of June. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the best time to go. If you look climatologically, if you look at the sort of the map of how much rainfall do you expect each month, June is the driest month of the year for the Faroes. It's still an average of, I think, 9 millimeters a day or something like that. So it's still going to rain. You know, you're going to expect rain. But yes, definitely the driest of the day. And being so far north, the days are very long. You know, light by 4 a.m., still light at 11:30 at night. So you've got lots of daylight to do what you want in, which was another sort of good thing, really. So yeah, I was thinking I'd see more. I think if you've got the choice, I would definitely go before school holidays. I think by the middle of June into July, when schools break up, I understand from speaking to my colleagues there, the islands do get very busy. The roads can get quite busy. But in June, early June, the roads were quiet. The campsites were empty, virtually. You felt like you had the islands pretty much to yourself, really. And it didn't feel like it was overrun with tourists or anything like that. I think the only downside, perhaps, maybe just in the early parts of June, not everything was open. So you would find some cafes that were closed up, and they're clearly they only opened in the holiday season and things like that. But to be frank, I think it's the best balance. You had the best both worlds, clear roads, good weather, or a chance of good weather, and a long daylight. Yeah.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia climate chart. I'm going to put my Michael Fish hat on and give a summary of June, because it does look, like you said, as though it's the best time to go. The record high temperature, although it is in August, June is not far behind at 20 degrees, which is pretty modest, actually, when you think about it. If that's the record high temperature,
it's pretty modest.
The daily mean maximum temperature in June is 11. It goes up slightly in July and August, but still pretty decent compared to the other months. But when you move down to look at the rain, it is the driest month by some margin. 57.5 millimeters of rain on average in June, compared to 74 and 96 in August, and in January 157.7. And in terms of the number of days, although the number of days of when you can expect to have more than 0.1 millimeter of rain is 18, that compares with 27 in December. So if you go cycling there in December and expect to stay dry, I think you, well, good luck if you get those 4 days.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend going in December and trying to cycle. I mean, the Faroes, being where they are, they're in the way of every weather system that comes across the Atlantic. And they're a very verdantly green place, almost incredibly green everywhere you look. But there are no trees except for what's in private gardens or some nurseries places like that. So in the cities and towns, a few secluded areas you might find there's a tree somewhere. But the vast majority of the islands are completely treeless, and they just get every single weather system that comes across. And the water and the rain is really what has made the islands look like the way they do. It's interesting that the way that the land responds to rain, because those first 3 days I was there, when it was raining quite a lot, the hillsides are absolutely covered in the water just pours off the hillsides. It seems to just emerge from the highest point you can see, and there's waterfalls literally every few meters. And as you go along the road signs, there's waterfalls coming down by the road, and it looks spectacular. They quickly sort of dry up and stop. So once the rain stops, and when I was cycling around, the waterfalls had gone, except for the bigger ones. But yeah, it responds really, really fast to rainfall. What the tourist board says is, and this was actually interesting when I read it, they said that the bit of advice for anybody going there, if you've got rain when you arrive, just wait 5 minutes and you'll probably have a dry spot to do something. And that is exactly what I had. Almost laughable at times, because I would see heavy rain starting, get rain, I'd get my waterproofs on, and happened several times, you'd get your waterproofs on and it would then stop, and you think, oh okay, do I take them off, do I carry on, because it's going to carry on raining, but no, so you'll take your waterproofs off and then you get wet again. It was almost just not worth it bothering putting them on in the end, and just know that you would dry up. And it was the same with the clouds, because it just seems to be one of those places where the rain would just come in bursts and the clouds would come across the hilltops and then they would go. So yeah, it was true, just wait a little bit and the view you want to see will arrive, or the rain will stop. Certainly true in June anyway. I couldn't say that for December. My having been there in December, and I'm going back there again in January this next year, I suspect what I'm going to see is darkness and rain. But that has its own beauty.
Yeah, it's like the old joke, isn't it? If you stick your hand out of the window, I think this is in the context of perhaps Yorkshire where I live, if you stick your hand out the window and it gets wet, it means that it's raining. If you stick your hand out the window and it's dry, it means it's going to rain.
It's going to rain. Yeah. They call it the land of maybe for this reason. You know, if you've got anything you want to do there, if you've got any arrangements, they'll say, well, maybe we'll see what the weather's like, because you can't predict it in that regard.
In terms of facilities for cyclists, are there any? I think I know the answer to this already, because I would imagine it's the same as it is on places like Shetland or the Lofoten. Are there any cycle paths, or is there any signage for people to follow?
So mostly no. I found one cycle path on the last day, which I was completely amazed by, but actually I was cycling next to an empty road, so it kind of seemed superfluous. But in the main town, Torshavn, there were quite a few cycle paths and cycle signage. They've actually got that set up pretty well for cycling. And the drivers, I have to say, I never had any issues with anybody cycling through the city or anywhere else. Very courteous. So yeah, they've got a pretty good set up in the cities. And outside of that, there's no sort of real infrastructure as such, because it's not that busy. And I think even on the main roads, they're quite wide and have a little bit of a verge. I never felt unsafe cycling on those. The exceptions are the tunnels. They do show where that's not allowed, and they don't really give any advice. So you can arrive at a tunnel and think, well, am I allowed to cycle through it or not? I think if there's no signage, then you are. And I did find one other, I think it was probably a footpath, but I used it anyway, which got me off of a road that was on a fairly fast road on a curve, which you couldn't see what was going around. And that one had a very steep drop off into the sea on the one side. So it was pretty adventurous in that regard. But outside the cities, the roads are very good and very good quality as well. I was amazed. I was surprised when I came across a road that had a pothole on it. You know, it was all very nice.
Did you manage to meet many of the locals when you were cycling? And what do people do on the Faroe Islands?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't quite answered it myself, to be honest with you. What do people do? It's a really good question. Everywhere seems, it's an island that definitely seems like it's wealthy. The houses are pretty nice by my standards, certainly. But I think there's a lot of people that work in the fishing industry. Tourism industry is certainly very sort of significant in certain parts of the island. But outside of there, I'm not sure. So that's still a question I haven't really quite worked out in my head. But I did spend some time thinking, well, who lives here? What do they do? And it's not something you can answer. But I suspect that maritime services, fishing services, is probably the predominant sort of industry. Everybody seems to have, I think it's quite one of these locations where everybody's quite wedded, has quite a strong link to the land. So certainly a lot of people have or own parts of the island or plots of the island where they can graze sheep or graze lambs and so on. And they actually do use them to stock winter larders and stuff like that.
It's perhaps the ultimate or one of the ultimate working from home locations.
Oh, yeah.
If you're in the IT industry and you never have to go to an office and just everything is online, presumably they have good internet connections.
I was going to say they have a fantastic internet connection. Pretty much the whole islands are covered by 5G. I didn't test that out as such because I was being a bit of a cheapskate. I didn't get a SIM card there. I just relied on Wi-Fi access, which all the campsites had. But no, they've got really good internet connection because they've got a an internet cable connector that goes via the Faroes that connects the US and Europe and so on, I think. And so, yeah, it's super fast broadband in the Faroes. So you're right. I think there are probably, I never had a conversation, I'm sure they said that there are a number of people now who come there and they just do work from home, they're office based there, you know. But it's fine if you like darkness for 6 months of the year and rain. But actually, having said that, with the connections of the flights, it's less than 2 hours to London by plane, same to Copenhagen. So you can get connections to Europe pretty easily. But you just have to accept that sometimes the weather does delay flights because the airport is pretty, I was going to say rudimentary. It's not rudimentary, but the airport is in the bottom of a valley, and flying in and out of the Faroes is quite an experience. The airport was, I think, originally built in the Second World War and used by the British. And it just is literally in the valley floor. You fly in over the sea and out over the sea. Yeah, if the weather is bad, I suspect that flights get delayed quite a lot. Same for ferries.
It'll definitely go on the list of places to visit. And I'm just thinking, I could, from where I am in Yorkshire, you could get the ferry to Rotterdam from Hull. You could cycle up, and I've always wanted to do this, cycle up the coast of the Netherlands into Germany, around the corner, Bremen, and then head up on the coast of Jutland up to Herschel, where you get that ferry, then jump on that ferry, go all the way to the Faroe Islands, spend, I don't know, how long do you reckon it would take to have a really good exploration by bike of the Faroe Islands?
I would say you need a minimum of a week, and that gives you some opportunity to do some of the ferry links to the islands to the south and to get to the northeast part of the Faroes as well. A week and a half is comfortable to allow for some weather days, and 2 weeks would easily allow you to get around the whole place. And I think that would probably be enough to really have done it, really got to all the key places. So somewhere between a week and a half, I would say, is what you would ideally need. It depends how often you want to stop and look at museums, or whether you want to combine. I think actually it's a good place to maybe combine it with some walking, because there are some really interesting walking trails of parts of the island that get you up to the sort of more remoter parts that look really good. And they've actually, I saw on the side of the road, and I think in the videos I took of it, there's some new signage that at the start and the end of hiking trails that give you a load of information about the route and what there is to see and stuff like that. So yeah, I would say you'd need that time. And I agree with your idea there. And my wife and I were talking about it in the future. I'm going to go back and do them again, because I want to see those parts I didn't get to. And I think you're right. That route from Rotterdam up, get the ferry across. That's certainly a good adventurous way of getting there. It'd feel like you're going to somewhere remote and different by doing that. So one thing I would say about flying, it's too easy to get there in a way. If you've got the time and you can do it by ferry, I think you'll probably find it more of an experience.
It's just a pity that there's no ferry from the Faroe Islands, or there doesn't appear to be one, to either Shetland or Orkney or mainland Scotland.
Yeah, it's a shame, because the ferry that goes from Denmark scoots just past the northern tip of the Shetlands. So you'd think it would be pretty straightforward to do a stop there, but they clearly haven't got that factored in just yet. Maybe we need to start putting an ask in, you know, make it a link up those destinations for tourism purposes. I think that would be a good idea.
I wonder if you could persuade a local fisherman to just let you hitchhike on his or her boat and and just drop you off when they got somewhere near the north coast of Scotland.
Yeah, having been on a few odd fishing boats, I'm not sure I'd enjoy that journey. But yes, it's surprising. It does seem like an obvious one to do. Maybe in time that'll happen. Maybe in a few years there'll be a link, and that would be good.
Yeah. So by the sounds of it, it is definitely a place that you would recommend people to go on their bike.
Yeah, I think the thing for me is it's got the advantage of being somewhere that really feels remote. Everywhere you go on there, because it's everywhere you're going is you're looking out at the Atlantic Ocean. You've got these big bare hillsides that look quite different to anywhere else in the UK, or as you say, maybe Lofoten, but they're quite unique in the way that they look. So you can, I think it's a good place to go if you want to have your first really proper, like, go somewhere that's different from the UK, go somewhere that's got a remote feeling to it, but it's still safe enough, you know, has still got options, because the road networks are good. The bus networks are brilliant outside of bank holidays, but the bus networks are very good. So you can always use them to get back to somewhere or shortcut a destination. The campsites are good as well, and pretty much everyone's friendly too. So I think it's got that mix of safety in terms of your journey as well, but feeling remote and different, so adventurous. You know, I certainly got that. I was really happy to be there. I'm really looking forward to go back again. There's just something about the islands that feels different to anywhere else I've ever been, and it's well worth it.
And did you get any strange looks from people because you were on New Brompton?
Yes, I got some people remarking at the campsite. I think there were kind of one couple who were actually, I think they were actually from the UK, but they had hired a camper van and were going around there, but they said they'd seen me at a place called Saxon, which I'd cycled to on the second day. And they'd remarked, like, look at that person on that small bicycle, that's crazy. And so we were talking about that the next day. But actually, I think cycling is around the Faroes is the better way to do it. Cars, you know, doing a car tour of it, sure, you can get around the islands pretty easily. But when you cycle, I mean, you hear and see everything. And there is so much to see and hear as you're cycling along. The waterfalls, there's lots of wildlife, the birds there. It allows you to just stop and explore some of the sort of more sort of interesting little things that you come across. So there's things like monuments to fishing vessels that have had a disaster, you know, some historical sort of context there. There's some old Viking villages that you can stop at easily. And I just think it's the right way to get around. And the advantage of the Faroes, as soon as you go out of the main town, which is itself interesting, but as soon as you come out of it, you're in that landscape and you never leave it. There's just no sort of parts, other than the tunnels perhaps, there's no parts to cycle through that get you from one nice place to another. The whole place is a bit like a national park, I suppose. You know, you're always within the environment that makes it interesting. And if you start off at Torshavn and head up the mountain road and then sort of start working your way to the east, it gets even more spectacular the further east you go. So yeah, I'm definitely going to go back, do those northeastern parts, do the islands to the south, and possibly do some walking as well.
Aside from the Faroe Islands, have you got any other plans on the horizon to go elsewhere on your bike?
Nothing certain. Work in next year is looking pretty busy, so I don't think I'm going to have much time to do much, but I'm sure I'll fit in a tour probably in the UK. It'll be a local one. And I'm actually tempted to do the another H.G. Wells tour and follow the War of the Worlds route, which I haven't done yet. I was going to do that years ago after we spoke the first time, but that's probably on my next to-do list. So that's only a short tour, but it's one that's got a lot of stopping to go and look at the landscape and what still remains of what's in that story. So that'll be my next one. I'll probably record that one and do a video of it as well. Because actually that's something I did new on this trip, the Faroes. I did record it and I've put it on YouTube. So it's not very professional, but it's there. So, and I'm pleased I did that because it you know, I find it's a nice thing to sort of look back on and remind myself what it was like and how that worked. So, yeah.
Where can people find your YouTube channel? What's your handle?
So I'll just double check this myself. But if you search up Tristan Newey, just my name on there, Tristan Newey, and I've got there's four videos up there of the Faroes trip. Hopefully it pops up fairly easily for people to find.
Yeah, I've found it already. In fact, they're quite long videos, 23 minutes, 21 minutes, 26 minutes.
Yeah.
30 minutes. Oh, that's elsewhere, but yeah, that's there must be quite a bit of footage on there to watch.
Yeah, I tried it. It's I think it's one of those things. The first time you do it, you look back on it and think, "Oh, that sounds a bit amateur." But I'll have to work on that. I enjoyed doing it. I think videoing can get in the way sometimes of the ride, but actually, it just lended itself to doing it. I wanted to have something to remind myself of the trip, so and to look back on it and think, "Okay, yeah, that was good. That's what I did." So it's there if anyone wants to see it.
So if people want to get in contact, a good way to get in contact would be via a comment on the YouTube channel, presumably.
Yeah, that's a way to do it. Yeah. I have an account on Threads and that'll probably get hold of me as well, just under Tristan Newey. So either of those would work. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking to me again and good luck when you go back there in December. Is it this December or next December?
It's January. I'm going just after Christmas, going in January, the new year. Yeah, yeah. I should be taking my waterproofs. I don't expect to be getting out much.
Yeah, and your torch.
Yes, and a torch.
Okay, right. Well, enjoy the trip when it comes up and thank you.
Thank you.
So that has been episode 97 of the Cycling Europe podcast. Thank you to Tristan Newey for his fascinating chat there about visiting and cycling on the Faroe Islands. Next week, next Monday, hopefully, I'll have caught up with the final podcast in January, which I recorded back in 2025. And that's going to be a chat with a woman called Helen Rivers. She did get a mention on the podcast a few episodes ago, so some of you might remember that. If you can't, then go back and listen. See if you can find her name, because she did contact me last year. As a result of that, she's going to be reappearing in the next episode, which will be episode 98. At that point, I will have caught up with all the podcasts that I've recorded, but not yet published. So that's all to come. If you'd like to contact the podcast, then it's cyclingeurope.org/contact, especially if you're that person who knows everything there needs to be known about cycle touring podcasts that I know nothing about, apart from this one. And if you'd like to help support the podcast, then it's cyclingeurope.org/support. Thank you as well. I keep forgetting to mention him. Thank you to Rob Ainsley for providing the music to this podcast. I'm actually going to see him talk on Friday of next week at my local Cycling UK / CTC group in Halifax. He's going to be talking about mixing cycling with canoeing, which should be interesting. In fact, there's probably scope for a podcast there. I might ask him, see what he says. So that's my plan for next Friday. If you happen to be anywhere near Halifax on Friday the 23rd, yeah, Friday the 23rd of January 2026, then Prescott Street, the Odd Fellows Hall, it's where you'll find Rob Ainsley giving a very engaging talk about cycling and canoeing together, although probably not at the same time. So thank you for listening and happy cycling.